Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on ReclaimedRadio.com. And tonight it's going to be Know Your Narcissist with my guest Roger Walker, who I'll call in a moment. We kicked off with some loosely narcissist-related tunes there. And the first was "I Used to Love Her, But It's All Over Now," which is a pretty sound piece of advice, followed by Horace X, "Is You Is or Is You Ain't My Baby." And we finished off with the Georgia Satellites, "And You Got Me Tied Down with Battleship Chains." My levels are looking just a little low. Perhaps I can get a bit of feedback from the chat box on that one. Might be able to find the right knob because I'm back on the mic and the mixer this week. So I'm going to not waste any more time. We'll bring in Roger Walker, who's very kindly joined me on the show tonight to talk about this subject. Roger, welcome back to Dr. Rock's radio show.
Nice to hear from you again, bud. I'll put my hands up immediately. I've just put a promo in the chat box because I make colloidal silver, so I put the website to my company. I make the smallest and most highly charged colloid in the country now.
I've got fairly high volume on you. And a bit. I'm also going to try and turn myself up. Hold on, does that one...
Turn me down, because I'm self-attenuating, Nick.
You're self-attenuating, okay.
I am, and you can't see it. Thank God it's radio.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, don't come that sort of thing with me, mate. Okay, let's just see if we can find that on the...
Talking to you so you can get a signal from me to adjust, Nick. Hoping you're well and everything's good down there.
Oh, it's really cool. Thank you very much. Let's just try and... God, I hate having to do all this stuff. I really wish I had an engineer. Let's just...
Some little sticky labels and put arrows on, Nick. It helps.
There we go. I don't seem to be able to pull you down any. Hold on a moment.
Okay. I'm just wondering what I can do about that.
This is a lot of fun, isn't it? Like I say, I really wish that I had an engineer on this. There we go, that's looking a bit better to me. Certainly my volumes are louder. I think everybody's sounding all right, though. You're not crackling or anything.
Babushka's put turn up the volume in the chat box. That might be you, not me.
Yeah, indeed, I should be a lot louder now. That's about the best I can do, but you're...
Okay, no, you're good for me. I've turned the volume up on my comp, so I'm good there.
Excellent. You can maybe just talk a little bit quieter, and that'll do nicely. Okay, well, that's going to be the best we can do. I can talk a little bit louder. I think I've got myself about as far up as I can go. I'm clearly going to have to find a few more settings in this broadcaster of mine. Yep, there we go. That's looking pretty good as far as I'm concerned. And most importantly, that we're not getting any of the damn crackle that we got last week. So, first of all, Roger, I'd really like to thank you for giving a name to the problem that, as you know, I've been struggling with for some time.
Yes.
It was a real revelation to me to have the word narcissist mentioned. And I think what you recommended for me was a 55-minute YouTube vid called "On Narcissists and Narcissism" by a self-identified narcissist. Perhaps you might like to introduce that to people to start with and tell us why it's so important that we understand this as well.
Okay. Coming in from the big picture, we're at the end of an empire, and there are a number of psychologists. Anne Mann is a particularly notable one in Australia. She co-wrote a book called "The Epidemic of Narcissism," and it's been cultivated into society. If you look back from 1980 to now at song lyrics, there were lots of songs about we and us. Those went through the floor to almost nothing coming up to now. And the songs that are about I and me and what I've got have gone through the roof. So it's all about the I. It's not about the us. You won't get songs like "When Will There Be a Harvest for the World" anymore. So there is an epidemic. It's been cultivated into society. You know, basically, it's like the social justice warriors. I'm here, I'm breathing, give me shit.
The social justice warriors certainly a pretty key part of it, isn't it?
And I think they're a collective exercising the same phenomena. Think of the behavioural phenomena of a narcissist and then put 10 of them together screaming at you from the back of a lecture theatre. Because, of course, narcissists love temper tantrums. And that's worth mentioning, actually. I sent you a picture earlier today, and I want people to try and get hold of this as an idea. You're standing in front of a 40 to 50-year-old man or woman, but inside there is a 9-year-old. They're emotionally underdeveloped, intellectually shallow, almost totally incompetent, but they'll talk a talk. They cannot walk. So they spend most of their life bigging themselves up, creating an avatar, that's a fictional entity in their head, of who they like to think they are and what they want reinforcement for. But what they actually play out in the world as is completely different, so that you can spot them as being vapid hypocrites. And that's partly to do with something called Dunning-Kruger syndrome. Should we go through the diagnostic criteria of narcissists? Because it might help hone in on why they do what they do, the way they do it.
Let's find out how to spot these devils, shall we?
Okay, now there are 9 accepted behavioural traits of narcissistic personality disorder. So let's go through those first. Then I'll go on to Dunning-Kruger syndrome and then the diagnosis, because they split down into subgroups and it might help you identify individual ones.
Right, so I'll just sit back and crack a beer then.
Do enjoy, relax. Now then, ladies and gentlemen, the first behavioural trait of a narcissist is grandiosity. They have a larger-than-life personality. They over-exaggerate physically and verbally. This is quite a lot of them, but not all of them. In the 9 criteria that I'm putting out, imagine they're 9 sliders on a graphic equalizer. So you could have somebody who's got a lot of grandiosity, but not much of one of the others, and likewise the other way around. So they've got a color to them. The second is arrogance. They're domineering, and they win through argument, not debate. They're irrational and they always interrupt. And you'll see that on the television. If somebody's countering an argument that party B doesn't like, they'll just start talking over them. That's not intellectual debate. That's throwing a tantrum because they want to win. That's all. Now, the third one is a preoccupation with success and power, and they're control freaks. Everything must go their way, but they have to live vicariously through others to get it because they're incompetent, but they have a high overestimation of their ability. So that's grandiosity, arrogance, and a preoccupation with success and power. 4, lack of empathy. This is the big one. It's worth knowing about. They lose all related positive emotions of the heart, compassion, humility, etc. And all they run on are the emotions created by the ego, which is the individual I. And the only emotion they can enjoy from all of the egocentric emotions is arrogance, the sense of superiority. It's the only emotion they can enjoy. The problem for them is this. When they feel arrogant, they believe they're right. And I use the word believe advisedly because they can't think. They're irrational. They can delude anything. They can turn things upside down and inside out just to stay on that knife edge of arrogance. Because if they don't, it's fear, anger, rage, all the way down. And if you keep pressurizing them, they'll play the victim and burst into tears as if this was anybody else's fault other than theirs. Now then, 5. Belief of being unique and special, omniscient, a supreme being, everyone else is inferior. So they have no sense of equanimity in meeting with like-minded people and having a chat without the idea of winning or losing. And, you know, maybe finding a bigger truth than any of you had when you started talking. They've got to prove you're wrong, and they are always right. They have to be right all the time. If you criticize them and they feel they're not right, they'll lose that arrogance. They'll fall into fear. They'll see you as a threat. They'll get angry. They start getting rage-filled. Now you're off to the races. That's it. They've gone. They've no emotional control. Now, the other thing, a sense of entitlement. They should always get what they want from others and kill all threats to that agenda. And I use the word kill in inverted commas. In other words, remove them, get rid of them, anything that gets in the way. Pure selfishness. A sense of entitlement is pure selfishness. So to put that in perspective, the opposite of that emotion is caring. They don't. They can't. They don't have any positive affect. They only feel their negative emotions generated by their ego because they invest meaning in their thinking. That's what Buddha discovered, the cause of all suffering. Right, 7, requires excessive admiration. Now, they need to be the center of attention. And if you listen to them talk, they have a vernacular that's all of their own. They'll use a lot of the first person pronoun. It'll be about I, me, I did this, and then so-and-so was with me, and I was with so-and-so, and they'll name drop, and it's all about me, and it's all about I, and it's not about the banking system or the pharmaceutical companies or the government or Brexit or anything external. It's just about them. And what they want, not so much as adoration, is affirmation. They want you to go, yes, you're right. if anyone wants to go on the internet and look up the classic painting of Narcissus looking at himself in the lake, on the other side of the lake, who the hell's that? There's a woman. What's she doing there? That woman is the nymph Echo. In other words, however big the lies of the narcissist talking about themselves as something they're not, the nymph Echo would always agree with them. The perfect lover for a narcissist, but he's lost at looking his reflection in the lake. Now, number eight, exploits others, makes assumptions about people to perform character assassinations. Now, in there is hidden things like psychological projection. And the cute thing is you can diagnose them from what's projected at you because it's only their flaws they can throw. Because of the lack of empathy, they only experience their own shortcomings and nobody else's. So they'll dress you up with lots of negative labels like, oh, you don't understand me. You've never really loved me. I don't think you're really a team player. I get the feeling you're disruptive. And what they're doing is they're blaming you for all their own faults. They can't process guilt, so they have to tar and feather you to make you look beneath them. In other words, they're shitty, but your shit's even bigger.
I can say is that absolutely, the ones I've been dealing with,
the last one, and then I'll just summarise them. Nine, envy of others. They've got no intimacy or emotional connection because of their lack of empathy. So people who get on easily and the conversation's flowing and they're having a laugh, they can't join in. But they believe they're victimized, not incompetent. Get the idea? So they rationalize it as, oh, I'm being victimized for whatever reason. Why don't they see me for who I am? Well, they don't, because that's not who the narcissist thinks they are. How they play out in the real world is not the same. So let's go through those again. One, grandiosity, larger than life, wants to be the center of attention. Two, arrogant and domineering. They believe they're right when they feel that emotion of arrogance. Arrogance is the emotion of self-deception. They're wrong every time. And that's why they're fucked up idiots who look for confirmation bias.
Just a quickie, Rog, we have to be careful with the language on this. We're on proper radio, mate.
Oh, sorry, I do apologise.
That's all right, sorry, should have made that clear.
My apologies to all the listeners, we've got an infestation on the planet. Preoccupation with success and power, lack of empathy, can't feel your emotions, so that they don't realise either that you can feel theirs. And that's where the diagnosis lies, because they don't know that you're feeling what they're feeling, because they can't feel what you're feeling, so they think everybody's like that. Get it? Now, the belief of being unique and special, this can be purely the sensation of having been a narcissist for 30 years of their lives or more. They live in arrogance. It's the only safe emotional place inside them. They have no love, and attention is definitely not love. They need adoration and affirmation. Sense of entitlement. Because they're so special, they should always get what they want. Requires excessive admiration. They actually want affirmation for who they're lying about being. They exploit others, they're selfish, so they'll be quite underhanded, which is why narcissism is a criminal insanity, like psychopathology and sociopaths. And they envy others, but they can turn that round in their own head and think you envy them, because they'll then convince themselves that the envy they're feeling is coming off you, even though it's their own. you're talking about a condition that is utterly irrational when it comes to the intellect. It's all emotionally driven. If you think they have no empathy, no positive affect, so they've got no happiness, love, they've never experienced ecstasy in their lives, they've never made a connection during making love with anybody, they've got no creativity, they have really poor ideas, if any, and all they experience is their own egocentric emotions, which is things like loneliness, hate, anger, depression, sadness, hopelessness, fear, guilt, and arrogance, the only one they like. And they've got a monstrously precarious emotional balance, and they will do anything to defend it. Because it's egocentric, the ego will literally kill to maintain its idea. It's where you get the idea of a fundamentalist. It's somebody trapped in an idea, not somebody having ideas. The moment you burst their bubble with something like logic and reason that proves that they're wrong, the infidel must be put to death.
Well, you don't seem to be able to burst their bubble, as far as I can tell.
Oh, no, we'll come on to that later. There's definitely ways of doing that.
Well, it's certainly true. Yeah, we'll look for some solutions a bit later. But, I mean, I must say that we're dealing, as you know, with a fair variety of these people one way and another. It seems to be a bit of a nest of them. And right. Basically, they do absolutely fulfil pretty much everything you're describing, except that sometimes, rather than grandiosity, there seems to be, I get what appears to be a feeling of being a victim. It's not vulnerability.
Oh, yes, that's the other side of the coin.
Right.
Yes. So it's either or. If it's usually women narcissists, you've got to be. Let's go into the types there are. Yeah. Then it might make sense. You'll have cerebral narcissists, people who think they're fucking geniuses, and they are the complete
careful,
opposite.
Careful with the F-bombs, please.
And think they're unbelievable geniuses, and they're the complete opposite of that. And then you get somatic narcissists. These aren't always, but are most likely to be found in places like gyms and women's salons. They want to look immaculate, and all they are is eye candy. They're very shallow, but they want to be adored because they're narcissistic due to their looks. And of course, that has problems as they grow older, because what they can do is then flip to becoming a cerebral narcissist when they don't look as good as they did. Now, underneath those two headings, there are also functional and dysfunctional versions of those those forms of narcissism, and there are covert and overt. And the best way to think of it is, put if you have like somatic narcissism, underneath put covert and overt, and underneath that put functional and dysfunctional to each of them. So there's like that's the granularity of shades of grey, if you like, in diagnosing them. So let's take an intellectual narcissist. They have a fantasy about being a genius. Now, if they're covert, they'll slip that out very carefully, and they'll play a very good game of being normal until something goes wrong, and then they'll expose themselves. Every wolf needs a sheep's clothing, and eventually they'll come out from behind their mask and have a quick stab at you. The overt ones are easy for anyone to diagnose. We had somebody come and join us at a group that you know about in the Midlands. I was outside, he was chatting about something. I could see he was completely off beam with it. And he turned to me and said, "What do you think?" So I went, "Well, I see it's more like this because of this, 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 and the other." Because he didn't get his bias confirmed, he threw a temper tantrum immediately in front of everybody. It was spectacular. And I stood there, thought, okay, I see what's going on here. And part of dealing with a narcissist is to be unmoved by them. Save that for later on, and we'll develop that. So you've got functional and dysfunctional. The dysfunctional, anybody can recognize. They're of no use to anybody. They're emotionally underdeveloped. They'll even threaten to beat the... I can't say it on the radio out of me.
Thank you.
I've got the idea now. Sorry, Nick. And it was just spectacular. I just stood my ground and very calmly carried on speaking to him. And the trick to do in a situation like that is just go, "Well, I'm terribly sorry you feel like that," because you're reminding them that they're feeling it and that it's not your fault. Mm. And that puts them on the back foot. So know that there are visual narcissists, intellectual narcissists. There are covert and overt versions, but more on the looks. It will be overt in looks, but maybe covert in behaviour, if you get my drift.
Yeah. And okay. Can you help yourself by giving these people the adoration they appear to be looking for?
That's now you're moving into the section how to deal with them.
Yeah.
Save that for later, because I've got plenty of it. It's good fun. You okay. can play. Yes, because they're the epitome of self-deception. They really, it's the only thing they're good at is deluding themselves, because they have to have that emotion. So intellectuality falls second to the need of the ego. So essentially, it's sad because the narcissist is having the absolute what's it stuffed out of them by their ego running their emotions, but they don't realize it because they're too busy blaming everybody else as if anybody else was responsible for their emotions, and they're not. Hence the phrase on the internet, I think it was, that Jewish bunny talks quickly, is very good. Ben Shapiro, facts don't care about your feelings.
Mm.
And the truth is the most toxic ingredient to a narcissist. They cannot face that.
Don't seem to know what it is, as far as
they do. No. If you confront them, you'll get. I can make a narcissist explode if I know I'm in front of one. I've just got to listen to what they talk about. I'll know what their weak point is, and if I launch at them, I can make it happen. Mm. You know, you can play them, as I say, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, that's of course what they're after from you as well, isn't it? They're after your weak points, and that's what they do to you, in my experience, is they attack your weak points, having wormed them out of you if you're not careful.
It's psychological rape, correct. What they're looking for is, which button can I press to cause suffering over there? Because they want control. They have no morals. None. They're a criminal insanity. They have no morals. And I actually heard a guy actually verbally say, well, I'm actually not interested in morality. I'm more into ethics. And I spun on an instant. I thought, somebody who's not into morality, this is going to go down well. Somebody's just put vampires, babushka, well done you, they're energy vampires. One of the ways they practice this is very tiring. That what they'll do, they'll get a conversation going, right? But they'll get you to do most of the talking. But what they'll do, they'll adumbrate the conversation. In other words, as you talk along, they'll just do the sort of, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I knew that. Yeah, that's obvious. What they're doing is they're hoovering your energy. They're dining out on being a better version of you than you are.
Yeah, that is very spooky. That is most unnerving. You know,
it's almost like having your personality stolen.
I'm pretty confident in my dealing with people, as you know, and I found these guys really, really difficult to deal with. In fact, you end up kind of frightened, you know?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The reason being is you have empathy. I know you do. And they carry a lot of fear. Be careful. It's not you being frightened, but you picking up on their fear. That's different.
Mm. Yeah, that's a bit subtle, isn't it?
Right. Let me give you a term we use at the Buddhist Center that I gave to them, and I stressed it with great importance. I said, this is the place you've got to arrive. You've got to be empathic and sensitive and sensual, yet imperturbable. In other words, all the information's coming at you. You know what's going on outside you. You can feel it, but it doesn't rock you. You're in the middle of all these emotions, but you're feeling them, but they're not moving you. Can you get with that?
Yeah, that is the Buddhist middle way, isn't it? That's what I mean.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's Buddhist right thinking, because it's thinking that is problem solving, not for the self, and therefore doesn't suffer from the egocentric emotional needs of the individual. In other words, the idea being, obviously, Buddhism in that is, if you solve a problem for everybody, you accidentally solve it for yourself, rather than solving it for yourself and hang everybody else. That's a different way of going about things.
Well, that's a nice, tidy explanation. Can we just deal with Mid's query in the chat box as well? He says this is very similar to psychopathy.
Yeah, they're similar, but a psychopath is different from a narcissist. Let me explain simply what the difference is. Let's start off first with psychopaths are born. I'm afraid that's it. You're going to be born with a psychopath. A sociopath is manufactured, and so is a narcissist. They have to be. A narcissist has to suffer such enormous trauma that they literally hide their love and their heart so far away they can't go and find it again. That's tragic in a way. Now, a psychopath is born. They don't experience any emotions like a narcissist. They have no empathy, but they also don't really have any emotions of their own. They certainly experience serotonin rushes and things of this ilk, and are the people that will take risks. So if somebody's going skydiving, the psychopaths will go, oh, great, yeah, I'm looking forward to this, because they have no fear. A sociopath is somebody who will develop psychopathic traits, and that usually comes from the group ethos. So think of the mafia, the triads, black gangs in America, anywhere where you've got collective violence run by gangs, like, say, lawyers, judges.
Banksters.
MPs. The whole system has become pathologized. That's why we're where we are. There are five control systems on the planet's surface, essentially religion, government, banking, commerce, and law. And all of them have become pathologized. So that's what we're dealing with. And that wave of, I remember talking to you years ago, and I said to you, do you feel like there's a wave of pathology coming down from above? And you said, wave, it's a tsunami. And I thought, yeah, that'll do. You know, it's rapid. The sane and empathic are having this wrap around them. And they realize They finally woken up to the fact that they're okay in a fucked up world, not that they're fucked up in an okay world.
Careful with the F-bombs.
Sorry. They are functional in a dysfunctional world, not dysfunctional in a functional world.
I can see I'm going to have to try and get some sort of bleep device built onto this for this kind of interview,
sorry,
aren't I?
I know we're... I'm going to write a sticky note in front of me.
Yeah. The thing is, we're kind of used to the internet radio, and this is though it's internet radio, it's actual proper. You know, it's like the real thing. This one.
Don't swear on the sticky powder. I'm sticking it to the computer. Right, it's now covering part of the screen. I hope I don't get the wrong end. Good. Yeah. That's there. That's reminding me.
Very good. Thank you very much. So we can basically expect you're not going to make a successful politician unless you're kind of like on this scale, are you?
Well, you've got to ask yourself, why does a politician become a politician? And why do they want to become the top of their party and the PM? It's control freakery. And it doesn't matter whether it's good or bad. All it means is they can exercise more than they've ever been able to exercise before. So basically, this country runs despite its government, not because of it. Put in a simple way. And that's the problem. The very people you want to go into politics are the people that never would, because they don't want to run anybody else's lives or tell anybody else what to do, unless it's to help them.
I've been saying that for years, that the very people who want to get voted in are exactly the people who should not get voted in.
Yes. Let me tell you something about narcissists, which you'll spot very regularly. It happens outside narcissism, but it happens inside narcissism hugely. And it's a thing called Dunning-Kruger syndrome. That's D-U-N-N-I-N-G, Kruger syndrome, K-R-U-G-R. Put simply, these are people who are so stupid, they're too stupid to realize how stupid they are. Because you have to have a reasonable degree of intelligence to know that you don't know something or can't do something. So people like you and I play music. I play guitar relatively badly. But if I'm in the presence of somebody who's playing well, I'll have the humility to turn my eyes and ears to them and start asking questions like, how did you do that? You do that really easily. Can you teach me? Then you learn something, you grow, because you recognize you're in the presence of somebody who can do what you do better than you do, or somebody who's doing something you want to do, but you haven't started yet. Now, the narcissist thinks they're the top bollocks. So when they pick up a guitar and play, you're sitting there thinking, this so-and-so can't even keep time, but they think they're brilliant. It's a bit like Les Dawson when he did his piano playing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. He looked as if it was absolutely fabulous. He gave the body language of it being, you know, really moving, even though he was hitting all the wrong notes. It's like that.
Yeah. So we're back with Don Rumsfeld, really, aren't we? We recognise when there are known unknowns, but for the narcissist, it's all unknown unknowns, all of it.
Oh, well, if you want people to look at, Katie Hopkins is worth a look-see. She's definitely a full-blown narcissist. Who else? Trumpy himself is, it's got to be said. The guitarist from A Baby We Were Born to Run. Bruce Springsteen, he was interviewed on Channel 4, and he described Donald Trump as a completely self-obsessed, egocentric narcissist. That was the phrase he used. It was breathtaking. And I thought, if a guitarist can spot it, but artists are sensitive, so they can spot insensitivity.
You must have
Dunning-Kruger syndrome is cute. It's an overestimation of ability and talent, and then if you put them into the test in the real world, they just fall apart. They can't do it. So they talk a talk, they can't walk.
It's funny that, isn't it? Because before we started talking about this subject, I was trying to work out whether I was dealing with an incredibly clever, subtle person or a very stupid one, and it was extremely difficult without the labels to actually sort it out.
I said earlier, they use language differently from us. We'll try and explain our thinking to each other and put up models that we can conceive of and play with. They don't. They will use very soft terms, very fluffy, very vague, very superficial. And what they're using are defense mechanisms. They're trying to stop you finding them. But they need the conversation to keep going because they want the attention. So over the years, they've worked out really cunning ways of using language to have a little nip at you without you even noticing, maybe. Just a little. They cut. It's like a death of a thousand cuts. They slowly grind you away.
And sometimes it seems that they're not actually talking to you as such, which is another rather strange feeling, that they're kind of talking at you, but dealing with something that's standing behind you or something. It's very, very odd.
Mm-hmm. They do talk at people because they want attention. They don't talk to you. You don't have a reciprocal conversation that develops and grows and builds and gets deeper. What you have is like, it's going along the surface of a lake and you're thinking, well, I'm the one providing all the information, but all the other individuals do. So the crack is, if you're ever in that situation and somebody is surfing on your energy and pretending to know what you know, if you can, spin it through 180 degrees and throw a question at them about something they've just said. And go, oh, that's really interesting. Can you tell me more about that? And seem really interested. We're back to playing them as if, like, you know, you're hanging on the seat for their every word. But what you'll find is they take about 7 seconds to come out with anything. They'll make noises like, basically what it is. So they'll, if you like, bluff for 7 seconds and then start saying something. And if you've asked them and you know your subject and they don't, but they think they do, there is nothing more hilarious than the problem I have is trying to keep a straight face. Because you can play them well and truly once you know you're in front of them and what their weak points are.
It's amazing how many situations where asking questions is the safest thing you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And what? Because then you put them on the back foot, that you're making them quietly justify themselves, and they don't like that. By the way, somebody's just put in the chat box, what they lack is intellect. They more than make up for in self-esteem. That's a very good point, actually. They do overblow it. That's the whole essence of Dunning-Kruger syndrome, is people who overestimate their ability and talent. So, they, as I say, they talk a talk. They cannot walk. They also lack morality, and that's well worth remembering. They are a grade 9 narcissist. Is probably one of the most dangerous people you can be in front of. There's Andreas Breivik was one. He murdered 64 white people wanting to start a white supremacist movement. Hang on a minute. Why would you kill the people you want to start a supremacist movement with? That is utterly irrational. That was a massive temper tantrum.
Did he make any attempt to explain that?
Oh, it's better than that. Let me tell you what happened when the police found him there. They went in, Andreas Breivik, gun in hand, with literally a room full of dead people and blood. And he's got a cut on his finger. And he insists that he must have a plaster. Look at my finger. Look what's happened. Get me a plaster and do it now. And he was so commanding that they actually got him the plaster before they did anything else.
That's the police.
That's how powerful they can be.
What's this guy's name?
Andreas Breivik. He was a Swedish a grade 9 narcissist, and he wanted to start a white supremacist movement. When he was in the dock in the case, he had no remorse. His face was completely blank, didn't give a shit about anything. Then they played him a recording of his manifesto in his own voice. While it was being played to him, he started to tear up, because as far as he was concerned, he was listening to the voice of God. Just as Kanye West does. He calls himself a god. Really? He's a talentless non-event with a massive ego.
Oh, dear.
And a bad
clothesline. when we say these guys are made, they must be made when they're really young.
Yes.
So well, where are the prime places of manufacture?
In the family, sadly. Now, it can happen a number of ways, so let's deal with them. The first one is you have an only child born into a family of affluence, so they get everything they want whenever they ask for it, because money's no object. As they go out into the world, they then have the problem of finding out that the world doesn't work like that, but they will still carry on that behavior as if, and there's the sense of entitlement. Don't you realize who I am? Why haven't you got me that coffee yet? I want that report here now, blah, 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 blah. Now, the other way they're made is much more sinister. If you have one narcissist, you might have two, but if you've got one narcissistic parent and there are two children in the family, what that narcissistic parent will do is turn one of them into the black sheep, and the other one will be adorned as, you know, everything is wonderful. Yeah, everything she does is fabulous. So you've got that child sitting on the lap loving the narcissist, which is what they want, the attention, the adoration. And they've also got another child over there that they can dump all their garbage on. You're nowhere near as good as your sister. You'll never be as good as me. Why do you always fail at school? Blah, 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 blah. So what happens is they're browbeaten from the word go. So what happens then? Square one. They lose connection with any positive affect in their heart. It's been hurt so badly that cannot be shown to anybody or gone back to ever again. So now they've only got the emotions created by their ego, the individual self, and they've got no empathy. The shock is so great, they've cut themselves off from feeling the outside world. In a way, it's sad. In another way, it's hilarious. But then, you know, there are two sides to every argument and more than two perspectives to any problem.
Well, it's amazing how much trouble's actually caused in what we call a family, isn't it?
It can be done with the greatest of ease. And that's usually the way it happens, though. A child that's been given everything it wants from the day of birth because the family's well off, or it's been cultivated in by splitting two children. One becomes the black sheep, the other is adored for everything.
Makes you wonder whether perhaps our old kind of like tribal lifestyle was perhaps a little more healthy.
Oh, considerably more. In fact, remember, it's argued that if you go back far enough, sex would be orgiastic, and it would be a very hugely spiritual experience because the mothers would know whose children were theirs because they gave birth to them. But it doesn't matter who the father is because all the men get the food for everybody in the tribe and all the women look after the children. So you've not got the sense, you've got a huge sense of belonging, massive sense of belonging.
Yeah. And it makes you realise, doesn't it, that, I mean, we've realised for a long time that that divide and rule is one of the major simple gameplays that's being used against us. And the family, which is kind of so bigged up by, I don't know, religion and marriage and vows and all of that, turns out to be perhaps not quite what we've been told it is.
Mm. You see, you've got to look at it this way round. Men will always sacrifice themselves. That's that. Greater love hath no man that he would lay down his life for another man is down to this. It's very deep in our psychology. If you've got a tribe of 200 people and you've got 100 men and 100 women and there's a war and the tribe is left with all the women and only one of the men, you're laughing because he can impregnate them all and get them all pregnant in the first year to build the tribe up to 200 again. Now, the problem is if you kill all but one of the women and you've got 100 men left, you are absolutely extinct. You're done. In other words, we men, I'm afraid, are the sacrificial sex. To continue, we need women, not men. So we'll go out and do all the jobs in the open air and take the risks. Why wouldn't we? We love the women, so we'll take the gamble for them because they're more important than we are.
Mm. I'll tell you what.
Tell that to some lesbian SJW.
Well, we're not going to go into the second wave of feminism, which certainly is something that's crossed my mind a couple of times in the last few minutes of this conversation. But I think something that possibly is worth considering is that, of course, in the First World War, the first mechanized war, it was mostly still the men that were getting killed. But yep. Now we know the kind of wars they're fighting in Iran and Afghanistan and stuff, 90% of the people that are dying are civilians, and that will be women and children as well as the men. So you're
Go to the Ukraine when it was imposing I don't know how many million people, tens of millions of people died, and they were actually told not to eat their own children. It was depraved beyond all imagination.
Yeah, that's actually a piece of advice that's given in the Bible somewhere. I remember reading that and thinking, what, they have to tell people not to eat their own children? Give me a break.
I know. What happened to make that necessary? But yeah, I'm afraid socialism doesn't work. But there we go. Back to narcissists. Dunning-Kruger syndrome. So we've got the shape of them. What we need to know is what sort of behavior do they exhibit? Now, a covert one will surf conversations and will just drop in the odd word here and there. An overt one will want to take control of that conversation. Look at me. Aren't I fabulous? Talk about me. They also don't know where they stop. They think the whole world is a reflection of them. They're so egocentric. As a consequence, if they're miserable, everybody must be. And if anybody else is happy, it's because of them. Really, for real. You've got to play around with how irrational somebody can actually get. And the best piece of advice I gave to a man recently, who's been married to a narcissist who abuses him horribly for 30 years, was don't try and rationalize the irrational. Just remember they're the ones that can't think. Don't try and do it for them. They're not capable of it. So you can never rationalize with a narcissist because they don't run on rationality. They run on anything that makes sure you're inferior to them. They look down on you. They carry on with that air of arrogance. Otherwise, they're going to experience the other emotions. And of course, you know who causes that, don't you? It's you again, not them.
That is so frustrating, that particular trait. I have never come across anything that has made me feel more like giving somebody a good slapping. I haven't, and I'm not a violent man.
No, it's understandable what you say. You know, you can get like that because you just think what they need is a good kick in the wants it. And no, it isn't. That won't work. Of course it won't. Because you can't win again. Because if you do go and do something like that, they'll lie about you behind your back. And of course, they've now got the opportunity to play the victim.
Oh, that's another thing. This business about about talking about you behind your back at every available opportunity. Now, you never get to see that, but in my recent experience, you do definitely get the overwhelming feeling all the time that it's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
Again, very weird. You know, you get
to feel all this. They're pathological liars, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to harness what are euphemistically referred to as flying monkeys on the internet. These are enablers. These are people who will side with the narcissist when, say, you confront them in public in a group, and they'll have already teed up quite a few people where they've always done this, you know, and he's done that, he's always doing this. It's all lies, but what they're trying to do is get a bad image established in everybody else's mind that they can then play on. But the beauty about telling the truth is you never have to remember anything. When you're a liar, you've got to remember it all. So they're incredibly neurotic. Fear is usually the first thing that comes into play when arrogance starts to slip, is fear. They sense threat. The whole world is a threat.
Well, that's another thing I noticed, is that this business of lying and stuff, but they're incredibly good at sort of twisting and turning so that you can never quite pin that on them for some reason.
That's the time to interrogate them. That's the time to ask them questions. Be honest and say, sorry, that doesn't make sense to me. Can you just explain what you meant about the first bit? And dissect it and keep them on point. Because another thing, if you try and nail them down to talk about something in depth, which they don't have, you'll find them flying around their own psychological space, looking for anything to pick up that might be of relevance. So they'll go back in time 2,000 years, they'll swear at something. You know, or if you're getting a bit close to them, they'll break the moment. They'll go, oh, would you like a cup of tea or coffee? I'll just go and put the kettle on. And they'll get up and leave the room.
Now, there we have actually come across a solution, I think. In this particular case, we actually managed to get what has basically been a three-round email conversation on a bang-to-rights, you-screwed-up issue. So and that has proved to be incredibly useful because it's your first chance to actually pin it down. When you can see it written down and you can see them not paying attention to what they've said before, and you can see them not remembering it, and you can see them coming up with what are ever more pathetic excuses. It's, I think, possibly unique, in fact. I mean, we're very, very pleased that we managed to pull that one off, because, again, it kind of actually makes concrete stuff which previously you've only been able to suspect because you've never been able to pin them down, because they'll just go, look, well, I didn't say that, you're imagining it, or all manner of other things.
Oh, you're mad, you must be delusional, like me.
Yeah, well, gaslighting is another thing that seems to be pretty much embedded in this process, making you feel you're going crazy.
A lot of that is mask building to start with. You know, I had a woman years ago as a patient, she was diagnosed with depression. I went to see her, and it's painfully obvious within about less than a minute and a half that she'd got a personality disorder. As time grew by, she was a grade 6 dysfunctional narcissist. And she would start sentences like, oh, I don't think you realize I'm a healer. Now, being a healer is a great label for a narcissist to put on themselves, because you don't need any qualifications, any experience, any knowledge, any ability or talent, and you don't have to register with any professional body. So any that you know, the wolf in sheep's clothing, a lot of healers are actually narcissists.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh
afraid
dear.
So.
Mm.
And you'll get people who pretend to be spiritual as well, even though they've indulged in no spiritual practices, have never experienced the spiritual domain, and because they're not talking from real-world personal experience, it's shallow again. What they've done, they'll echo chamber what they hear from other people, and they'll tell other people's stories as if they were their own. They're an echo chamber, hence, you know, empty vessels make the most noise.
Well, once again, that was one of the things that came up in this email exchange, is that because it's such a bang-to-rights technical issue, this particular one, it's whether or not you're making mouldy apple juice in a pasteuriser.
You've got proof, though. That's what you did. You got absolute corroborative proof. I said it earlier. Narcissists hate the truth. If you've got evidence to prove it's true, then you've got the narcissist, because they will, even in front of you, they will run away, they'll make excuses. No, I didn't type that, it must have been somebody else, my email's been hacked. Any pathetic excuse will do, just so they can carry on saying it's anybody else's fault. They can't process guilt.
Well, what happened in this case was we kind of pointed out how it was all done properly, and within 24 hours we got an email back telling us what we'd just told them, as if it had been their idea.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I've had similar. I did a legal case for a guy to get him off. It was a credit card debt. It was a fairly good one. It was about £9,500. And I realised what I'd fallen into. I thought, oh, no, I've been suckered into it. He's a narc. You know, I thought, well, it'll be over in a couple of cases. I'll just go with it. And then he didn't contact me, or I didn't contact him for ages. And about 6 weeks later, he sent me this epic email, which explained to me everything I tried to get him to understand in the courtroom. And I'm thinking, this is hilarious. Why are you telling me what I already know and told you? That's all I sent back to him, was just those words.
Well, this is one good thing, isn't it? Once you realise what you're dealing with and you can start picking up on these things, there's a little bit you can do about it. I mean, you've actually just hammered your way through 45 minutes and a bit, no problem. It's just... Let's, before we have a couple of tunes, let's just deal with another of Midrin's queries in the chat box. He says, is there any way back for a narcissist?
Wow. The first answer is no. But let me colour that in first. It's a bit, you know, all or nothing. No, if they're old. If they're relatively young, there's the possibility you could break them out of it. But by the time they have habituated this condition for 15 or 20 years, they're so ingrained in it, they don't know anything else. Now, the other side of the coin is I've had an idea about treating narcissistic personality disorder, because I've noticed one thing about them. If they indulge in drugs, narcissists love cocaine. It feeds the ego. Now, hang on, that doesn't mean all cocaine users are narcissists. It doesn't play the other way around. What they don't like, and I actually gave somebody some ecstasy, and they don't like it at all. They don't have the upside to enjoy that being turned up, because it's not there. So what they get is this weird aberration of reality, and they don't get on with it well at all. And I wondered if you picked the right psychedelic, you could literally smash their ego to bits. And if you did it under the right clinical setting, you know, you could help them out of it. Because what you're actually trying to do is the biblical death and rebirth. It's not a death that happens as a physical thing. It's a psychological death, to be reborn as the spiritual entity that now has the control of the center of its own attention. It isn't taken away by the ego off into the psychological space to have games played with and to cause you suffering. I don't think you can cure a narcissist, but I'm not going to give up hope. But I have a feeling it's going to have to be by some form of medically induced catastrophic psychological shock. You've literally got to smash them out of the prison they've built.
That's pretty interesting, that is, because I'm aware that I'm told that one of the best, one of the most successful by percentage ways of dealing with heroin and cocaine addiction is ayahuasca. Apparently, it's a lot of people who go and take that in the proper situation do actually end up not physically addicted anymore, which is a pretty amazing change to make in itself.
All hallucinogenics, if they're good, should be self-limiting. In other words, you know, you've done them for a while, you get it, and think, ah, right, okay, I'm there now. it's all right, somebody's just put, habituated narcissist would have to get elected to be amongst their own.
They don't call him Nick Nomic for nothing, mate.
That's a very good point.
Bye, Nick.
Beautifully put. But no, I don't think you can cure narcissism except with a huge pharmacological intervention in a clinical setting. I don't think it'd be done any other way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, let's go for another couple of tunes. I've got 5 minutes lined up, so you can go and make yourself a coffee and
New Diamond.
just check out the yellow sticky that says "Don't swear." You're doing very well.
I've got it in the top left-hand corner, Nick. It's still there.
That's very good. We're going to go for Truck Stop Honeymoon and Your Mother is a Sociopath. One of my all-time favourites. Here we go. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on ReclaimTheRadio.com. I'm talking with Roger Walker about narcissists and narcissism. And when we come back, hopefully, we're going to talk about some of the many ways that you can defend yourself and maybe even start having a bit of fun. In the meantime, yes. Here is Your Mother is a Sociopath. See you in a minute, Rog.
Cheers, God.
There you go, that was the Motors, and You Beat the Hell Out of Me, which I think is probably the phrase you were after earlier on, Roger. Welcome back, dude.
Hello.
Yeah, I trust you got your coffee, mate. You could do with a bit of speeding up, innit?
That's right, I'm just checking the rest of my notes for the how we deal with this. Okay, got all that.
I must say at this point that one of the places, as well as the on narcissists and narcissism vid that I watched to start with, there is an extremely brilliant YouTube channel called Surviving Narcissism, and it is absolutely loaded with really amazing vids. And one of my favourite internet characters, who I didn't really know until recently, I think his name's Les Carter. He does several of the vids on it, and he came up with quite a lot of solutions. But you're the expert; we might as well let you get on with it first, dude.
The thing to do is you've the first thing about dealing with. I'll tell you what. Let's get the easy ones out of the way first, because it's the difficult ones I want you to be able to deal with. The easy ones are overt narcissists. You can tell you're in the presence of somebody I can't use words to describe on the radio.
Cool. Thank you.
In other words, George Carlin has a wonderful rant on that. He goes, they sound intelligent. No, he's full of whatever. They're just like a tirade of noise. Oh no, if they were a friend of a friend and you've never met them before, never have anything to do with them again. If you've got a somatic narcissist who's really pride and preeny and whatever else, you know you're in the presence of one. Okay, just don't be in the presence of them, but don't let them get you down. And don't. The problem is to be non-reactory to their behavior rather than get sucked in. That's what they want. They want to draw you in. They want to play the gaslighting, irrational game on you and then start blaming you for all sorts of stuff. And what they're doing is they're dining out on your energy. And I said it earlier.
And that's basically kind of any emotional response, isn't it? It can be positive emotion, negative emotion, but that is basically
as long
what
as
they
they're getting attention, they don't care.
They call it,
if they can't become famous, they'll become infamous. If you remember, what did Katie, is it Katie Price? Katie Hopkins, she called herself the biggest in Britain. Yeah, and she was proud of that.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't be famous, be infamous. So she's happy being infamous. It'll do. She's still getting attention. That's all she wants. And that's what they want. So they'll keep putting hooks in and getting you back. So you'll go through a phase which is, it's not really gaslighting. It's like love bombing. They'll big you up and go, oh, you're amazingly good at that. Oh, it's fantastic the way you do that. I've never met anyone quite like you. And they'll also start dropping in. It's incredible how much we've got in common, isn't it? Even when you're sitting there and thinking, hell, I mean, we've got nothing in common. They're gaslighting and love bombing you to get you in. So they have probably a bit like a paedophile. They have what do they call it when they ghost the children?
One minute, Rog. I think we've got our crackle back. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on another quick tune, and I'm going to hang up and call you back in hope that fixes it. We've done really well. I've got no idea why it's decided to come in now. look, we'll just stick on. Hold on. What's next?
Grooming was the word I was looking for.
Yeah, hold on. We're going to play This Town Ain't Big Enough for the both of us, and I ain't going to leave. And after that, hopefully we'll have you back online, and hopefully that darn crackle will have gone away. So here we go.
Okay, bud.
Here's the sparks.
Yeah. You're in charge.
There we go, a good old one from Sparks there, and This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, and I Ain't Gonna Leave. I think we recognise that. Hopefully we've managed to get rid of the crackle. I'm being told by BT that we've got a bit of a problem on our line, which might be what's causing this. I'll get round that hopefully by perhaps broadcasting from somewhere else next week and see if that's any different. And I've also been asked to make sure that people understand that whilst we might occasionally talk about the use of things like ecstasy and stuff, it is, these things are not policies that are endorsed by the station or necessarily actually by the DJ either, or the guest, of course. So, Roger, give us a go. Are you crackly, mate?
I'm crackly. I don't know why it's crackling up then, Nick. Sorry about that. I've actually unplugged everything that's superficial to the laptop.
Okay, right. Hold on a moment. We've got rid of the crackle, but you've gone quiet. So we'll just whip into the Pulse Audio. Keep talking, dude. Have you got it all together? Oh, he's gone. Oh, this is great, isn't it? What's that beeping noise? I've not heard that one before. Hold on. Oh, we're having fun here. Hold on. Let's just see if we can see what's going on there. Looks like I've still got you, Roger. Can't hear you talking.
Hello, I'm there now. It's all right. My IP address just changed.
Oh, great. Oh, that's brilliant, isn't it? Obviously, somebody's listening.
And I'm down to 53 now.
Very good. Hold on a moment. Now, obviously, somebody's listening and they don't like what we're saying, mate. Well, that's not the first time, is it? Right, okay, carry on. So we were talking about some of the things we might do to resist this. If you talk, I'll see if I can get a bit of control of your volume this end. What fun.
Let's talk about, well, we've dealt with the easy ones. If somebody is obviously very, very egocentrically self-obsessed, you're probably in the presence of one. Use your empathy and you'll know that there's a noise there, but there's nobody really home. With a somatic narcissist, somebody thinks they're wonderfully beautiful, well, you'll soon know that, because they'll have haughty looks about them. They'll look down their nose at you, etc.
Yeah, you're sounding great, mate. That's cool.
Oh, good. The more dangerous ones are highly intellectual, covert narcissists, because they can cover their tracks better. And what you're looking for there is quite a subtle misuse of language, and the fact that you feel like you're having things hoovered out of you without your consent. It's almost like they've denied you the right to say no. So how do we deal with these people? I would just dispense with those people. If you've never met them before and you don't need to have any relationship with them, don't, because they'll be more harm than good. They're actually worse than having nobody around at all. The lie for England as well. Their fundamental lies that they are a supreme being. They have no equanimity. So remember, they're looking down on you all the time. But don't believe them. They're the ones that are delusional. So try and stay completely emotionally calm and just go, okay, I get what's going on here. This individual needs to feel good about themselves, so they're making me look and feel bad so they can. That's all they're doing. It's a playoff. They're supposed to have all the power and not you, so they make all the decisions, because of course they're brilliant, they must get their own way, they've got a sense of entitlement, and they're selfish. Three, you're nothing without me. They think the relationship is down to them, not you. You're nothing in that relationship, and you wouldn't be anything without them. You're just here to prop my ego up. And that's basically what it is. They think that you constantly owe them something because of having massive selfishness and a huge sense of entitlement. They're going to want things from you all the time. And if you say no, there's something really wrong with you. To give you an idea, narcissists see human beings in the same way we use mobile phones. If the mobile phone doesn't work, we get a bit angry with the mobile phone. Maybe they think, oh, crikey, you know, why isn't it doing this, that, the other, and so forth. That's how narcissists see people, as equipment that should supply them with what they need. And if they don't, there's something wrong about them. And of course, they'll tell stories. Oh, you know, he's really selfish. He won't do anything for you. And they'll colour it the other end of the spectrum. So those are the lies they hold on to all the time to justify and stay in that one emotion. So what can you do about this? Can I just drop a name in for listeners?
Yeah, go for it.
It's a guy, a psychologist. This guy is incredible. Jack Panksepp. That's JAKPANKSEPP. He was the first individual that really looked at the emotional side of relationships rather than the intellectual and verbal side. His work's on the internet. He's well worth looking at. He's a brilliant man. He discovered the play circuit in just about every mammal. And, you know, when he pointed out, you think, oh, yeah, they do. They all have a play circuit. He's worth looking at by studying yourself for introspectively and seeing why normality versus narcissism is what it is. We've covered Sam Vaknin. He's worth looking at because he's a self-realized narcissist, and that's rare. But as he says, it's like becoming a self-realized coke addict. You might be a coke addict, but that doesn't bring about a healing. It doesn't bring about a cure. You just know you are one. You can't stop being it.
I think one of the things he said that most impressed me was that, you know, he can turn on the tears and all the emotions and all that kind of stuff, but it is just turning it on. He doesn't feel any of it.
No, that's right. It's fake. And psychopaths are the same. And, they have to fake it. So they sort of, it's like, I was going to say, it's like Theresa May dancing, because they don't get art either. Yeah, art means nothing to psychopaths. They don't have any feelings. I put it an extreme example at the Buddhist Center when they were going on about compassion. And I'm sick to death of Buddhists barking on about compassion. Yes, compassion is good and it should be cultivated. No two ways about it. Right, you're at a bus stop. You're on your own. This bloke's just come up, pulled a gun out and put it to your temple. You can surround him with all the compassion you like, but as a psychopath, he can't feel it. Mm. What are you going to do now that compassion's failed? This is the point. Yeah, it's a naivety. The psychopath can't feel it. You don't give him your wallet. He's going to pull the gun. It means absolutely nothing to him.
That doesn't necessarily mean that you should abandon your compassion, does it? I mean, I know, you know.
You save it for those who deserve it.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, so how would the Buddhist deal with the man with the gun against his head? That's the question.
Well, I'd give him my wallet quite happily. Quite happily. But anyway, so we're back. What can we do when we're dealing with narcissists? One good phrase to remember and keep up your sleeve is, I'm sorry you feel like that. That's a good one. That always throws them into a wobbler. They don't quite know how to handle that because they don't like talking about feelings. And the moment you're pointing out that they're feeling a certain way, they know they can't be empathic because it's not you that's sending them.
Yep. But yeah, that's number one on my list as well, is I'm sorry you feel that way, because it keeps you disentangled from their dynamic, doesn't it?
Yes. And it's exercising control without appearing to do so, in the sense that because I know what I'm doing when I'm in the presence of one, I'll go fishing. You can play them. Now, remember this about narcissists. They are the epitome of gullibility. So if you actually chat them up like the Nymph Echo and agree with all their weird premises about how fabulous they like to think they are, they will give you anything that you want. I mean that, but you've got to play them really well. You've got to be there going, oh, yeah. You can use like double-pronged things like, do you know, I still love you, Dr. Rock, despite what everybody else is saying about you. I'll always be beside you. Yeah, you know, you can play both ends at the same time. And that's another one that throws them. If you actually come in, I remember a woman years ago, she was a dysfunctional narcissist, and she said this to me. Oh, I don't suppose you know what it's like to be a single parent mother, do you, Roger? She said, the difficulties of being a single parent mother. So I said, what do you think you're doing wrong that makes it difficult? And of course, to a narcissist, that's appalling. So she went, I'm not doing anything wrong. So I hit the other side of the coin. Well, what do you think the mothers who don't find it difficult are doing right that you're not? Now you've got them caught between two opposites and they've got nowhere left to go.
And that, of course, is one. That was, I remember, one of the basic pieces of advice you gave me at the beginning of all of this was that, you know, you give them a question that takes them out into kind of the open field, as it were, and then start honing the questions in, seeking details.
You take control subtly by spinning it, because they'll start asking questions that aren't really questions. They're sort of, oh, I thought you'd have got that. You'd put a question mark after it, but they're not asking a question. What they're starting to do is deride you and put you down.
Yeah.
Yeah, they want you off balance. They want you off balance. If they get you emotionally off balance, they're in control, which is why I say you've got to be empathic yet imperturbable. You've got to sit there, know what's going on around you. Don't get moved by it. Take a breath, center yourself, ground yourself internally, and then play the game with abject rationality, because they hate it. You know, they know if you can out-argue and they're losing their temper and you're still staying absolutely still, that's the worst thing that can happen to them, because it shows them their impotence.
Yeah, I think you just casually swum over another really important one, and it's a good one, not just for narcissists, but for other situations that are difficult, and that is take a breath, or two, or three, because it enables you to, if you like, register the way you're feeling and deal with it internally before you come back with whatever it is you're going to come back with. I've been using it for years, working with bad managers in factories and stuff. You kind of breathe it in, breathe it out, and then you can generally safely get away with saying the first thing that comes into your head, even though it might be a bit close to the bone sometimes.
It's how it's offered, not what's said, Nick. You're right in what you're saying. If it's offered with equanimity, they have failed because they haven't got you rattled chasing after them, trying to explain why they're wrong. And they're just haughtily looking over to the left, thinking, you know, what an idiot I've got in front of me. Because they feel the more arrogance they feel, the better they feel, and the more they think they're right, which is why arrogance is the emotion of self-deception. They don't know how to interpret their own arrogance or any of their emotions. They're an 8-year-old. We're back to an eight or 9-year-old in an adult body.
Yeah. I noticed that Nick Nomics put in, "I'm sorry you feel that way," as a standard civil service non-apology. And that brings me to one that was always used in Yes Minister, which I think also works well in these circumstances, which is, "You might believe that, I couldn't possibly comment."
Oh, yeah, oh, that's lovely, isn't it, though? That's gorgeous, yeah. By the way, to Nick Nomic, thank you for the agreement. He's right in the way he said, be in the eye of the storm. In other words, let it happen around you, but don't be part of it. You're the stillness in the middle of madness, because if somebody's getting angry and you decide to join in, you've just got two people becoming more enraged, climbing up a ladder to out-threaten and enrage each other. That's going to go nowhere. So if they want you to do that and you don't do that, that shows them how little control they have over you. They'll drop you like a stone when you get that. Because they can't play you, and what you'll get next is blanked. If they're in a working environment, they will literally ignore you. It's like you don't exist in space.
So what about, "I can accept your faulty perception of me"?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. I've used this. I said, what is it now? When somebody, I can't remember what the term was, it was thrown at me and it came to me instantly in the moment. And I said, "Well, the one thing that's lucky for me is I'm not you, and nor am I the idea you have of me in your head."
That's another one I've got, is that I have no right to control how you see me.
Well, and the other one is, well, just because it makes you feel superior doesn't mean you're right. There's a world of difference between being correct and feeling superior. Yeah, and if you talk about emotions, that they don't like. You know, if you thought, "Oh, you're looking a bit down today, you know, are you okay, you seem depressed. Are you feeling all right? How are you feeling?" You know, if you come in at that angle and they don't like it at all, and they will do anything to break the moment. So what you'll have is a discontinuous conversation where they'll just say anything about anything to get off topic, or maybe take control of it, because they are control freaks, and they're back into the, "Oh, well, I've had this and I had that and this happened this morning, and then my husband did this and then my wife did that, and blah, 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 blah." And then what you've got is a monstrously long gaslighting lie.
So presumably you try and bring them back to the central point at that point.
It's difficult, as you know. You won't get them to. They can't negotiate. There's no middle ground. They won't meet you halfway. It's either all my way or else there's something wrong with you. So again, if someone's got the epitome of selfishness and they want to get something out of you, you don't have the right to say no in their eyes. But when you do, that gives them the excuse to talk to your mutual friends about what a tight-fisted so-and-so you are. So you've got to watch for that, and they'll blow it. If they're relatively dysfunctional and relatively intellectually retarded, their lies will come back to haunt them, because we find this out as children. You know, if you tell a lie and somebody holds you up on it, it's like a hydra. It starts growing heads. You've got to lie about the lie, and it becomes more and more untenable, and then you run away and cry in a corner. And then your mum comes over there and says, why on earth did you do that? And you can't think why, and you realise it was a stupid thing to do, so you don't lie again. But they have no morals. Their words are a smokescreen to make you not find them.
And it is very like finding a small child in a kitchen full of mess, knowing that nobody else is being in there, and seeing them look at you and go, no, it wasn't me. I don't know what happened, but it wasn't me.
It's their fault. No, I've only just come in. Yeah, they'll come up with anything, and they'll do it. They become experienced at lying. They become very good at that. And they can dial up, they can dial up a lie to suit their convenience at the drop of a hat. But if you're chasing somebody as you did with empirical fact, it was written down, or there's an audio recording of them at a meeting saying it, they're stuffed because they can't leave the point. And you will keep bringing them back to the point, because what you're doing then, if you're in a group situation, is you're not trying to prove it to the narcissist. You're trying to prove it to the rest of the group that this individual is unhinged, and you know there is something fundamentally wrong with them, because everybody else can see a bit of paper with what they wrote down on it. Everybody else can hear the audio of what they said. The only individual in the room who can't own up to it is the one who wrote and said it. That's not normal.
Yeah, that's enough.
To the group, that's what you're doing, is you're using the narcissist to let the rest of the group know that they're that he's like this. And I did this recently with an overt one here. It was really weird. He came in, projected his arrogance to me, said a whole load of other things, and I just went, you have to invent people into existence, do you? Have you never discovered anybody in the real world? And he stood up and immediately started to go into a temper tantrum. Obviously, I went ice cold. I just sat there. I didn't put no expression on my face, and I looked at him, and everybody else was looking at him, and he was throwing this temper tantrum, and then quietly he sort of stopped and fizzled out, and I just looked at him. I didn't say a word. I just carried on staring at him. They want attention, but when you're silent, it does things to them, especially if you can be silent internally.
And maintain the poker face.
Yep, you've got it.
Because emotions don't always come across just in your words, do they? It can be your body language as well, which they'll be paying attention to.
They're looking out for anything where there's a flaw they can have a go at. The guy came back the following day, again, with some people were already here. And he said, we had a great debate last night, didn't we? And I went through. I said, how can projecting your emotions to me, throwing a tantrum and not putting up any credible argument be called a debate? There's the grandiosity. As far as he was concerned, it was a debate, because he wants to seem intelligent. And all it was an 8-year-old not getting his own way. Pathetic.
I think another good point you made there, and something I realised fairly recently, is that audio recordings are a good thing, but also trying to make sure there's always somebody else there if you're going to have to deal with these people. Because sometimes, we've got to admit that actually getting away from it altogether is the best way of dealing with it. But because there's so many of them, and you're going to find them in the workspace and in the family and in places where you have to deal with them, then it's best to try not to deal with them on your own.
Oh, absolutely, because they can, if you excuse the phrase, they can shit stir for England. They really are. They're just control freaks. They don't care whether it's good or bad. They don't know the difference. They have no morality. But the problem comes is, if it's your other half and you've got kids, that's really problematical, because you're going to have to deal with it some way. If you're in a relationship where there's no kids, that's easier. If you're in a working environment, yes, you've got to get other people present. No two ways about it. Or even raise suspicions. And I did when, in a place I worked at with a guy there, because it was painfully obvious that he was what he was.
Yeah.
But yeah, have witnesses, because they'll lie about you behind your back. And they can't then contest that the events were different than they were at the time, but they'll try and do that. They'll change reality into anything that suits their purposes. But yeah, evidence. They hate evidence. They don't like facts. They don't like the truth. It doesn't allow them to run around.
I think we need to deal with the anger thing here as well, because if any of these methods become kind of particularly successful, then anger is going to be a move towards rage, isn't it? And these are other things that I think are important, because none of us like to make people angry. Well, I used to, actually. I had it revealed to me by a lady who I'd never met, who sent me a 9-page horoscope which somebody had commissioned. And one of the things it said, she said several things that were a bit of an eye-opener, but one of the things she said which absolutely stopped me cold was, you managed to get away without losing your temper by behaving in such a way as to make other people lose theirs. And I thought, oh my God, that is absolutely bang to rights. And that really changed my behavior.
You were a wind-up merchant, were you?
I was a wind-up merchant. Oh yeah, especially people ideologues and people who are easily... I used to love it, and I was a head storeman, so I was in a position where I could make people really angry when they clearly needed toilet paper desperately. I would make them fill in a stock rack with the right stock forms and preferably bring me the empty toilet paper pack. Really, really, I was bad, man. I was. I was young, though.
Oh, dearie me. No, obviously, you know, that's it. We've all done... I mean, I've done daft things in my youth. We all have. The hope is we learn from them. Narcissists never learn from anything. And they're not autodidactic, most of them. They can't learn anything new under their own steam because they have no passion, enthusiasm, commitment, focus, or anything like that. They don't have any creativity. They're not chasing anything that is good in the world, if you know what I mean. Mm. They're just chasing... narcissistic supply from people who will adore them, but they also despise their adorers as well. That's the catch 22 for them. They love them and hate them at the same time. They need them, but they hate them.
Another thing, a concept I've come across, is this idea of narcissistic rage, which I think I've also seen on a couple of occasions.
The thing to do is remember the bite, that usually the bark is worse than the bite, but don't forget Andreas Breivik. And there is, in fact, a grade 7 narcissist, can't think of his name, he's still in prison in this country. He murdered both of his parents after he'd raided 250,000 from a trust fund, and they found out and questioned him over it. And he beat them to death with a hammer. The thing was, he was such an ingrained grade 9 narcissist, he went back a fortnight later to get a change of clothes. Well, and the place stank. The only way they were found was the local neighbourhood. They were rotting in the house, and the neighbours could smell them.
So encouraging narcissistic rage might not be helpful then.
What you'll do, they won't want to lose their balance themselves, and it's very precarious, so they'll fall into anger quite quickly. That's the time to go, oh, I'm terribly sorry you feel that way. Would you like a cup of tea? Then you break the moment, get up and do something else. Break that moment, get out of the seat, move from where you are, get a glass of water, do something. Take your jacket off, put it over on a stand, anything to get away from the moment. That way you know what you're in front of because it became angry at nothing at all. And you've triggered that and you now know what's going on. So break that moment completely. Don't continue. Which is probably what you do. I mean, I do sometimes because their bark is often worse than their bite, and they'll talk a talk they can't walk. So the issue threats they can't fulfil in the real world either.
So possibly under those circumstances, another suggestion I came across was the phrase, "Your anger is not my responsibility." Under those circumstances, that might not be the best one to come up with.
You want to turn it off quickly because it's come out. Now you know. Now you know you've got an 8-year-old in front of you.
Yeah.
And you've got to play with the idea that this individual can't feel you, so the words you come out with are just words. They don't have any sort of emotional sense or sense of gravity or anything about them at all. It's very, very bland and shallow. And they see the world as objects. The world to them is two-dimensional, not three. There are just these things moving around making noises that they know they're one of. And they think everybody else is like them. But the people they envy are those that... have empathy and can have meaningful relationships and enjoy the company of each other. You know, they're happier for being together than apart, if you like. But the narcissists want people together purely for their own attention. So they resent that. They think they've been left out. So you've got to remember where they're coming from. Well, if you can get a handle on it, you can play them. I was going to say to you what you said earlier about self-help on the internet. Be careful. There's quite a lot of good stuff out there. The thing to do is put searches... How to manipulate narcissists, how to handle narcissists, how to defeat narcissists. Put those in YouTube and just see what everybody else did, and you'll get a commonality come out of it.
Well, I think I must admit that the Surviving Narcissism YouTube channel is full of things that are entitled exactly like that. And you can sort of tell by watching the vids and by looking at the comments that you're dealing with a vast wealth of experience of this subject. It's not just the videos themselves. I don't normally read the comments underneath YouTube videos because they're mostly pretty vapid. But the ones on the Surviving Narcissism channel are amazing.
I went on one on Facebook for quite some time and then cut off it because it was taking too much time. And it was recovering narcissists. And I put in little standpoints here and there. And I could go away for the day, come back, fire up Facebook at the end of the day, and I'd have like 18 thumbs up on a little something I'd given them that I condensed what that individual story was actually down to. And they went, oh, I get you, I see. So there's not just the story, there's the functional why that happens in the world, if you know what I mean. Because those who are recovering from narcissism are discovering themselves again, if you like. So they're looking at their own emotions, they're repairing themselves, and they can look at the narcissistic personality disorder psyche and see some of the why they do what they do.
Okay, so you just used the phrase some who are recovering from narcissism. That was interesting.
Recovering from narcissistic abuse, sorry.
Okay, right, yeah. Fair enough.
Got that wrong. Yeah, narcissistic abuse.
Yeah. Okay, well, that obviously one of the great things I think about the internet potentially is the ability to share these experiences, and looking about that on the Surviving Narcissism has really been, I found, one of the most, seeing there's a kind of texture and a complexity when several people are dealing from their own point of view with what is basically a single well-identified problem.
Yes, because what you, in a generic sense, it doesn't matter what sex, colour, age, it doesn't matter what the physical appearance of the human being is. What's at work inside them that makes them do what they do is pretty much the same in all narcissists who are cerebral in that sense. They're not somatic. They're not looking at me, aren't I beautiful? They're the ones that are playing the game of life, trying to be normal, hoovering energy out of people, living in a fantasy world, looking for narcissistic support and people agreeing with them and giving them the affirmation they want. As you play with them, you'll find it's easier to do and they become less of a threat.
Yeah. So let's return to a question I asked earlier on, which is, can you necessarily get what you need by giving them what you think they want? Is that likely to work for you?
It can do very well, yeah. It depends how you play them. You see, you've got to look for what it is they'd like you to believe they are. So if they believe they're brilliant at something that they're obviously not brilliant at, just pretend they are, and they will adore you forever for it. And to the point where if you don't get what you want out of them, you can play the game in reverse and ignore them and play the ignore game that they play. And they'll come up with more hooks and you're back to love bombing, and they'll apologize. You know, I'm terribly sorry I said what I did and did what I did. But, you know, I just wondered if we could be friends again because, you know, it hasn't really gone very well for me. And, you know, I do think you're quite wonderful. And you'll get all that and all that and all that because they want it in return.
And you can get them to apologise, can you?
Oh, yeah, but they don't mean it. It's purely a strategy. They've got no morals. They're not really apologising. They're talking it. They're talking the talk. They're not walking. They don't feel remorse ever. they're talking it because linguistically they know if they put it over that way, they might win. They're just trying to achieve an end. It's as cold as ice, really. They're not apologising, but they're going through the routine of an apology. But accept such, and you've got them again. So then you can turn around and go, well, you know, I thought it was unusual for you to come out because you're not usually like that. You're usually, you know, one of the kindest, meekest individuals. You've got time for everybody, you know, blah. And that's it. That you're back. You know, you've got them again. And they'll go, oh, by the way, I wondered if you could go and get me a sensei because your husband works. And they'll do it. They'll go and do it. They'll do it. If you play them right, you've got to be careful, and it's short term. So you're then becoming the abuser in a way, so you've got to watch that.
Yes, yes, that's a very subtle point, Mr. Roger.
In other words, by playing at them, you are yourself playing to their pathology and being pathological. Jordan Peterson says it in his thing about narcissism. He says it's very good. If I'm a mirror for your narcissism, am I really your friend? Because if I'm a mirror for your narcissism, you're going to disappear and drown. And he's right. In other words, what we should do is actually out them wherever we find them in a sort of naming and shaming and go, no, we've got a halfwit here who is definitely an egocentric narcissist. Here are the conditions. Here's the proof. Blah, 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 blah. You'll see videos like Diane Abbott being shown to sort of lie and do her thing on the internet with Gas and heaven knows what else. There you've got it. You know, she's a full-blown narcissist.
Yeah.
A noise machine.
Which brings us to another point, I think, that needs to be made. And again, I'm thinking pretty much in the industrial context here, where you're sometimes forced to work for people who are very, very difficult to deal with, shall we say. Sometimes you kind of have to stand your ground, don't you? Sometimes a bit of confrontation can be reasonable.
There's a world of difference between... aggression is one thing. Affirmation is, to be firm in your stance, in your speech, and stand there and be unmoving is one thing. It's another to be aggressive. That's completely different. Assertiveness is not aggression.
So it's kind of, it's not wrong to say, maybe occasionally, look, I'm not happy about the way you handled that, or mismanaged that, or misrepresented me, or the situation, or whatever. It's kind of a matter of, like, holding your ground, claiming your strength in it, and maintaining your own dignity, which is a way of dealing with the situation that doesn't necessarily involve playing to their pathology, as you put it.
Yeah, the thing to do is, you're back to what we were talking about earlier, ask them questions. So if they, why did you say that about me to so-and-so? What made you say that? As if it's a done deal, it was said, but you want the reason why. In other words, interrogate them, get them on the back foot, make them justify their behaviour, but don't do it from the point of view of aggression. Do it from the point of view of, why on earth would anybody do something like that? As if that's completely... You see, they have no... Because they have no morality, they have no sense of social structure. They'll lie, they'll pit people... And the clever ones will pit people against each other. It's called triangulation. They'll play A against B by getting in between them. Because all they are manipulators. They just want to play on people's emotions, because they know if they can play on people's emotions, it makes them do things.
Yeah.
But if it's stoic, they can't, and therefore they'll dump you so fast their feet won't touch the ground, because they know they're going to get no narcissistic supply from you at all. So you're right, you have to stand your ground. But again, if you're in a working environment, depends on the gravity of the situation, what was said, and if it was said to a third party, you've got to witness that it was said. So you could go to the third party and say, is it right that so-and-so said this about me to you? And they will go, yeah, he did. Do you think that's true? Because hopefully the other party isn't narcissistic and you can rationalise with them, and we're back to pointing a finger at the problem in the room.
And of course, working some way towards redressing any chat behind the back that might have been going on in the process.
Yeah, that's only guesswork, though. The thing that narcissists don't get is the difference between objectivity and subjectivity, in fact and fiction. That's why they live in a delusional world. So you can't... They will drive past an empirical proof as if it didn't exist, if it suits their convenience. So you're never going to win the argument. So in a working situation, you need allies on board. And obviously, if it does get to a situation, you might want the personnel department involved. I involved the personnel department in my own company and said, look... There were two of us working for them who were both qualified at a relatively low level of shrinks. And we both spotted him and said, look, you do realise what you've got here, don't you? And we talked it through with them about, is an eye going to be kept on him? How long are you going to keep him for? And it was what happened in the end was half the company resigned. That's how catastrophic a narcissist can be, put in the wrong position.
Yeah, I can, yeah. Half the company resigned. My goodness. I can absolutely see that. Or over time, you just keep losing really, really good people and they don't come back.
It works beautifully. What's the name of the principle? The 20-80 rule, Pareto principle. 20% of the people in a company are making you 80% of what you make or doing 80% of the work. The other 80% are just turning up for the salary and doing 20%. So when a company starts to fall over, the 20% that know they're good at the job will be the first to go and get other jobs. What's the company left with? The also-rans. And then on the stock exchange, if it's quoted, you see a dead cat bounce and the thing falls off the face of the earth. And all it needs is one in the wrong place, as happened to me. It's why I took early retirement. Within 3.5 months, the entire marketing department of a pharmaceutical company, apart from a trainee, resigned. They hadn't got a marketing department.
Goodness,
and I said to the vice president, what's more important, this company or his career?
Mm. Just one person in the wrong place, mate. Person in the wrong place. That is so bang on. That one really has knocked home, which you've done well, because we're sort of we're 2 or 3 minutes away from me wanting to play a couple of closing tunes.
Remember the two-facedness of narcissists. It's the Jekyll and Hyde thing. It's the hiding behind a mask thing. It's why we tell our children Little Red Riding Hood. You know, that it might not be a gram. It could be a wolf in sheep's clothing. Watch out, all that glitters isn't gold. You know, how they first present isn't necessarily who they are.
So what about these grades as a kind of last closing question? What about these grades? Do they sit exams or something? What's the difference between a grade 9 and a grade 1?
Oh, a narcissist?
Yeah.
Okay, you know the 9 behavioural traits we started with? It's grandiosity,
yeah.
Arrogance, preoccupation with success and power, lack of empathy, being unique, special, sense of entitlement, requiring admiration, affirmation. They'll exploit others because they have no morals, and they have envy for others, but sometimes they think that works the other way around. Now then, a grade 9 narcissist has all of those. So a grade 6 narcissist could have any 6 of those 9, but may not exhibit the other 3.
Mm-hmm.
A grade 7, similarly. A grade 8, similarly. They might have one that doesn't play very high in their behavioural traits. So you could have somebody who's a grade 6 narcissist who's got the first 6 and maybe has the lack of empathy and arrogance as the biggest features of their behaviour, but they've got the other 3 as well. You could have a grade 6 narcissist who's got 4 to 9, lack of empathy, uniqueness, sense of entitlement, but they're not grandiose and they're not arrogant. They seem to be very even-keeled and they're undercover very well. They've learned to do it over the years. So their narcissism won't actually be as physically or verbosely grandiose as it could be in a covert narcissist. They're undercover, if you like. They're the sheep.
Yeah, I noticed that you say that they don't exhibit the other 3. That doesn't mean to say they're not there. It might mean they've just learned how to cover that up or deal with that one.
Or they're marginalised because of how the narcissist came into being. What actually produced them? What type of family did they come from? What influence? What cataclysm caused it? But you can't find that because they won't go and face it.
Mm.
It's the catch 22. They don't even know they've got a problem. They think everybody else is at fault.
Yeah. Well, for me personally, Roger, that, again, like the first conversation we had on this, that it's been really great. I mean, admittedly, we're talking in front of loads of other people, but it's been really great for me to have gone and experienced a bit more of what I've been experiencing and then to be able to come here and go into it in a bit more detail. I found this a very, very helpful conversation. I think from the chat box, several other people have as well.
I hope so.
So I'm very grateful to you for coming on and giving us the benefit of your experience. And hopefully the quality of sound's been good enough for me to get this one up as a podcast as well. So,
It's really that once you can start identifying, I mean, be careful because you might see them everywhere. Not everyone is. People can be egocentric without being narcissistic. People can have a bit of a tantrum, and they're not necessarily a narcissist. You're looking for the consistency of behavior over time. It's like a neurotic cycle they can't get out of. Truly behavioristic, not just a one-off.
Mm. Well, that's really great. Thank you very much, dude. I think what we'll do is we'll say thank you very much and goodbye at that point. I'm sure we'll be having you on the show on other subjects because I know there's other things that you talk about really well as well. But thanks for all the work you put into it. And thanks for the piece of yellow sticky that you put up there. And I think we were all right once we settled down. I'm still getting used to the rules here myself, you know.
If you're putting it up as a podcast, maybe they could bleep them out on the recording. I don't know.
I'm sure we can do something with that anyway. But yeah, it's all right, mate. Thanks so much for your time. And I'll perhaps catch up with you sometime tomorrow. We're going to play out with, once I can get back to my broadcast, we're going to play out with a couple more loosely narcissistic related songs. Funnily enough, you had your precog turned on again because I am actually going to play Born to Run, which is of course the best thing you can do, but I'm not going to go for Bruce Windscreen's version of it because I don't like that. I'm going to play Frankie Goes to Hollywood's version, which I think is really kicking. And we will, as is traditional, folks, we will finish the show with Motorhead and Move Over for a Damage Case. So thanks to all of you that have been in the chat room. It's been very full and busy in there tonight. And thanks to all of you that have been listening outside the chat as well. we will continue to try to improve our behaviour and our language. I did actually remove a couple of tunes from the playlist today because this subject actually does tend to encourage me to play all the songs I like best with the F-bombs in them, but I haven't. So we'll see you next week. Thanks to everybody for being there and listening. Big thanks to Roger for joining us tonight. Hopefully you'll all find that useful. And now you know what it is you're looking at, and perhaps a little bit of what you might consider doing about it. You might believe that. I couldn't possibly comment. Here's Frankie Goes to Hollywood. See you next week. Dr. Rock's radio show on ReclaimedRadio.com. Thanks for being there, folks.